When you're down and troubled and, well, you know.
Feelings. Nothing more than feelings.
Oh, Lord, that is so cheesy. But everyone has a song that gets them out of a funk or is there when you're down. Songs you can count on. How music can deliver you from evil. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, September 12th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away, but we'll be back on Monday. More bad business for Lehman Brothers, a look at global warming and powerful storms. The presidential candidates endorse the idea of government. I kid you not. And remember, Friday music to save the world. And you, Terrence McKnight, will fix whatever ails you. Those stories and more. But first, we have some headlines. Hurricane Ike is set to hit Texas later today or tomorrow with devastating force. Ike is a Category 2 storm, but it's huge and moving slowly, a very dangerous combination. Texas Governor Rick Perry is warning residents in the danger zone along the coast to get out while they can.
I cannot overemphasize the danger that is facing us. It's going to do some substantial damage.
Satellite pictures show the swirling clouds filling the entire Gulf of Mexico, although it's believed the storm will move quickly across Texas. Sarah Palin's first interview since she became John McCain's running mate aired last night. Sarah Palin told ABC's Charles Gibson that she's got what it takes to be in the White House, and she didn't hesitate for a second when McCain asked her to join the ticket.
You can't blink. You have to be wired in a way of being so committed to the mission that we're on, reform of this country and victory in the war.
On Wall Street, investment giant Lehman Brothers is for sale. The fourth largest investment bank in the U.S. tried to convince shareholders it could stay afloat, but has started looking for a buyer. How am I doing, Femi?
Excellent so far, John. A couple of other big stories we're still following this morning. A big day for Zimbabwe. Last night, President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai finally reached a power-sharing agreement. It's taken almost 2 months. But some members of the opposition party aren't happy with that deal. They say it gives President Mugabe too much power. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has kicked out the U.S. ambassador to his country. It's the latest move in a diplomatic tit-for-tat, pitting the U.S. against the leftist country and its fellow leftist neighbor, Bolivia. Venezuela has close ties with Russia, and it's the fourth largest oil supplier to the U.S.
Well, tamer politics in the U.S. I guess John McCain is going to be on The View and the Rachel Ray Show today. Oil prices around $100 a barrel. The Dow opens at 11,433. You know, if all else fails, there's music.
Good morning. It's Catherine from Harlem, and the songs that turn me around are Laura Nyro's Time and Love.
Time and love, everybody.
Love it, love it. But people, let's try to get out of the 70s and 80s. Could we please give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE? Can you help me there, Femi?
Okay, how about the 80s? Hakuna Matata from The Lion King?
Nice.
I do my housework to that.
All right, what did you take away from the Sarah Palin interview? That's also what we're asking. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Matuna, what is it? Matuna?
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata, right.
I'll look it up.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We got to reform government. We got to fix the economy. We got to create jobs. But right now, we have to restore trust and confidence in government.
The fact is that we have to have government. When a hurricane strikes, as it did with Katrina, we have to have a FEMA that works.
On January 20th, when John McCain and I are sworn in, if we are so privileged to be elected to serve this country, we'll be ready. I'm ready.
As you can hear there, three out of the four people running for president or vice president here in the United States were in the spotlight yesterday. Sarah Palin was interviewed on ABC television, and we're asking you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org what you think she still needs to be asked, what questions you thought were inappropriate. What's your takeaway, basically, from the Sarah Palin interview? But John McCain and Barack Obama, the two presidential candidates, stepped into a much more high-minded forum, given the pace and tone of the campaign lately, which has had much talk of pigs and lipstick, etc. There was none of that at Columbia University last night. But there was the Takeaway political director, Andrea Bernstein, who was there, witnessed the event, saw the events yesterday. Of course, 9/11, a very sober day. Both candidates appeared at Ground Zero together. It was an interesting issue-focused event. How did it go?
Well, the premise of this event, which was sponsored by the nonprofit organization Service Nation, is that the 9/11 attacks stimulated a spirit in Americans that they wanted to serve. And the event was designed to sort of encourage that and to talk to both candidates about their ideas of service, which has been a part of both of their campaigns. It sounded like it might be a snooze. It turned out to be actually pretty interesting and really sort of gave a window into their views of government and the last 8 years and the sort of challenges that they face in the next some 50 days. Tim McCain, now he had to criticize Bush without mentioning him by name. And he also was sort of, you know, he's been having this theme of government is broken, right. It's corrupt, it's wrong.
Well, the Republicans have been running against government for a generation, right. So he's got to both criticize government and endorse government at this forum.
Exactly. And to also defend some of the sharper attacks that have been coming from his campaign, and particularly his running mate, while not criticizing community organizing. Couldn't do that in this forum.
And I think that if we had asked for a concrete plan of action, both on the part of federal, state, and local governments, as well as by the Congress of the United States, as well as, frankly, talking directly to the American people, on the need for us all to serve this nation, I think perhaps we...
Was that a mistake?
Finishes. No.
That's actually what he said.
Yeah, he never finishes the thought because the end of the thought is President Bush messed up. He didn't capitalize on that moment in American history. So McCain pivoted to saying, but I still think there's a period of volunteerism in America.
So that was as close as he could get to say 9/11 was a lost opportunity for the Bush administration.
That's exactly right.
What about the community organizer deal? I mean, at the convention, they made much of this. I mean, they really turned it into a national joke. And Barack Obama is, of course, a community organizer. I mean, I imagine there were some in the audience there.
And he was asked at this forum.
McCain
was asked, do you know, what about all this negative campaigning? And isn't it just going to do the things that you say you don't want, which is, you know, bring down confidence in government and in politicians? And he was specifically asked about the derogatory remarks that were made at the convention by former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani and vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin about community organizers. This is how he handled it.
Governor Palin was responding to the criticism of her inexperience and her job as a mayor in a small town. That's what she was responding to. Of course I respect community organizers. Of course I respect people who serve their community. And Senator Obama's record there is outstanding.
You know, there's something disingenuous about that in the sense that so much has been made of these convention taglines, and yet in a forum like this, he sort of completely backs off it.
Well, it raises the question of which John McCain are we dealing with? I mean, in 2008, he felt that he was a victim of smears, and he really campaigned hard against them. Now, some of the people who ran that smear campaign against him are running his campaign.
Well, how did he defend the campaign?
He actually didn't. He just simply ducked the question. And then when it got to Obama, I mean, Obama had sort of, in this crowd, a bit of an easier road because he could criticize Bush for not capitalizing on the September 11th moment. He could say, we need to have government. Katrina showed us why.
Well, of course, he's in New York. So
he was in New York at his alma mater.
Yeah, right.
And this is the kind of a comment that he was making.
What we also want to do is to remind young people that if it weren't for government, then we wouldn't have a Civil Rights Act. If it weren't for government, we would not have the interstate highway system. If it weren't for government, we would not have some of our parks and natural wilderness areas that are so precious to America. And so part of my job, I think, as president, is to make government cool again.
That's interesting. You know, there's a front page piece in the FT today, the Financial Times, saying that Democrats on Capitol Hill are worried that maybe Barack Obama's a little too soft-spoken, that there's some stumbling going on in the campaign, and they're worried about the Obama coattails. That's a strong statement, but maybe Obama needs to be stronger this week.
Well, that is what everybody is saying. And his campaign has already put out a memo today to all interested parties saying, you know, we are going to step it up, but we were planning on doing it all along. Mm-hmm. And their take is we are still polling well in the swing states. This is not a national election, and we are doing the things that we need to do. Of course, the background of all of this is Sarah Palin, who's been on this interview spree with ABC. They now have aired three parts of, I think, what is going to be their sort of four-part rollout. And
I think there's going to be a Disney movie with Sarah Palin as the main character. Right. Well, anyway, evaluate the Palin interview for us, will you?
You know, Charlie Gibson, who's doing the interview for ABC, is under almost as much pressure as Sarah Palin because she's not granted a single interview since she got that phone call from John McCain. So all these people have all of these questions about her. And
it was something of a turnaround for the McCain campaign. Originally, they were saying she's not going to do an interview, and then all of a sudden she does.
Well, I don't think they could have gone the entire time. The question is, you know, how much more of this will she do? And I mean, she's been, you know, a whole group of Bush aides has been with her in Alaska prepping her. And you could hear that in her interview. But nevertheless, you know, she has a record as a governor of Alaska, which she's now trying to turn into this, you know, sort of I'm qualified to be vice president argument. And she also has an interesting row to hoe because on the one hand, her appeal is the sense of her being rural, small town. Mm-hmm. But she has to also argue that she's capable. So listen how she did it, for example, when Charlie Gibson was questioning her about Iraq this morning.
You said in 2007, you were asked about the surge, and you said, I've been so focused on state government, I haven't really focused much on the war in Iraq. Really? Somebody who wants to be vice president
haven't
focused on Iraq?
Of course I've been focused on the war. Of course I've been, as every American has been.
Why'd you say this, though? I've been so focused on state government, I haven't really focused much on the war.
It was
Iraq.
An honest answer for the question that day by a reporter asking me about Alaska Business Monthly issues was my focus being on energy independence and security, those things that Alaska could supply to help make this country better and safer.
Well, we should also point out that she thinks about Iraq because her son's going over there, too, so
clearly.
She has a connection.
And he left yesterday. But lest you think that the joint appearance at Ground Zero yesterday, the wreath laying, this nonpartisan forum signals a change in the campaign. Already, first thing this morning, 6 a.m., two emails in my box, one from the Obama campaign, one from the McCain campaign. The Obama campaign is showing that it means it by when it says we're going to get tougher with this ad, which is a step up from what they've been doing up to now.
1982, John McCain goes to Washington. Things have changed in the last 26 years, but McCain hasn't. He admits he still doesn't know how to use a computer, can't send an email.
Oh, my goodness. Are we headed back to, like, pigs and lipstick, or are we going to stop short of that?
Well, I would argue that this may be the first of the Obama sort of, you know, we're running an ad to grab your attention so that you'll play it all over the media type ads, which the McCain campaign has been so successful with. I mean, the implication is, of course, he's old. And they have this picture of him in 1982 with these big aviator-style glasses. Mm. They have somebody holding a giant cell phone. The implication is clearly he's a candidate who is out of date.
Hmm. Well, you know, the question really is, you know, at this point, you know, it's all about momentum. And, you know, as they said in the Clinton campaign, it's not so much whether you have the momentum, but whether you have it in the last 2 weeks of October. And I guess the events from here on out are the debates and then what is actually going to happen in the fierce campaigning that takes place in the last 3 weeks.
That's absolutely true. McCain could be doing great now and could be doing bad at the end of October. That would not be so good for him.
Hmm. Andrea Bernstein, Takeaways political director, joining us in the studio talking about Sarah Palin's interview. We want to hear from you on that. 877-8-MY-TAKE. What do you want to ask Sarah Palin? What does she still need to be asked? And you can reach us on our website at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE. 869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Of course, Sarah Palin gave that interview to ABC's Charlie Gibson that aired last night. It's also airing today and tomorrow. We asked a question. What did you take away from it?
Good morning. This is Christine from Connecticut. With regards to the Sarah Palin interview, I think definitely she has no experience. You can cover it up by saying you were mayor and governor, but we just have to pray that McCain lasts a long time, at least through his administration.
Giving the race to John McCain, Christine, there from Connecticut. But give us your take at 877-8MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Hurricane Ike.
Hurricane Katrina.
Hurricane Gustav.
Faye, Gustav, Hannah, and Ike.
This monster of a storm.
Extreme weather.
Hurricane.
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 You've been following the details all morning. Hurricane Ike is moving toward Galveston, Texas, a Category 2 storm, a very dangerous storm, top winds near 100 miles per hour. But, you know, it's another example of what we've been experiencing all season long. Hurricanes, tropical storms, tornadoes, extreme weather. Is it normal? Is it a seasonal cycle? Or is something going on across land and sea and oceans and all over the earth? Is the climate change driving this trend in storms? Our guest, Carrie Emanuel, is a professor of atmospheric science at MIT, one of the earliest scientists to predict that indeed global warming may create stronger storms. Professor Emanuel, thanks so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
You know, first of all, let's just give people a sense of the trends here in terms of frequency of storms and severity of storms. What are we seeing over the last 10, 15 years?
Well, in the Atlantic, the power of storms, the energy that they generate over their lifetimes has nearly doubled in the last 20 years.
Wow. I mean, that's a huge number, but in terms of everything that's going on in the Atlantic climate-wise, is that a giant event? Is that a tiny little blip?
No, it's a very large change, and we're still struggling to grasp why that's so. We think that part of it is global warming. Part of it is a recovery from an era of suppressed activity in the 70s and 80s, and we now believe that actually we had a hand in that suppression too.
Really? How did we have a hand in the suppression?
Well, there is another phenomenon called global dimming, which is an actual cooling of the planet that is induced by very small particles that we put in the atmosphere, in this case sulfate aerosols, again a byproduct of fossil fuel combustion, and that demonstrably cooled the planet, particularly the northern hemisphere in that time, and seems to have had a hand in suppressing hurricanes during the 70s and 80s, which were very unusually quiet if you look at a very long-term record.
So particulates in the atmosphere blocked sunlight and sun energy getting to the northern hemisphere. That caused a dimming. Now we've cleaned up that in the atmosphere, but we're adding carbon, which is an input for global warming, and it's driving these storms to have higher energy levels. Is that sort of the cycle we're looking at?
That's right. What we see when we look at the data is, first of all, a very strong correlation between hurricane power and ocean temperature. And also we see an uptick in the proportion of hurricanes that reach the upper categories, that is 3, 4, and 5.
Is there a counter argument? Again, I think there are a lot of cycles at work here. There are many inputs to climate. It is a complex question to model. What would be the counter arguments that this maybe is just episodic and doesn't have to do with climate change?
Well, of course, one does see something that looks like cycles in the Atlantic, and I think some of us have come around to the idea that what we thought was a cycle was merely a kind of an up-down pattern caused by this combination of global dimming and global warming, so that my own feeling is that there's not that much evidence for cycles. But remember, the Atlantic only has about 12% of these storms. The rest of them are in the Pacific and Indian Oceans. And when we look there, we also see an increase in the proportion of the higher category events.
So the trend is global, and both in terms of frequency and severity, no matter where you go on the planet.
Well, the frequency and severity questions are very tangled up. The Cat 1s and 2s, the weaker storms in many areas, are actually going down. And in fact, the global frequency of events seems to be dropping a little bit, and in fact, models predict that it will continue to drop. But I have to emphasize that at least in the developed world, the 1s and 2s really don't matter. They don't do very much damage. They don't take very many lives. It's the upper categories one worries about.
So, you know, there's a lot of talk in the global warming, inquiry that, you know, a couple of degrees a rise in the average temperature on planet Earth would produce catastrophic effects along coastlines, etc. What about an incremental increase in the energy of storms hitting the coast season after season? What sorts of direct impacts on architecture, on living conditions would that have?
Well, the destruction wrought by windstorms tends to go up with their power. But the question of hurricanes hitting coastlines is actually somewhat more complicated because global change also causes changes in the steering patterns, the winds that direct these storms. And this is an area where science hasn't converged. You know, it's possible that storms would tend to stay more offshore under global warming, or to hit them more systematically. I want to add one thing, though, that there is another robust prediction of global warming theory, is that a given storm is going to rain more. This is something pretty much everyone agrees on, and you have to remember that, especially in the developing world, it's the rain that kills. Hurricane Mitch in the late 1990s in Honduras killed about 12,000 people. Those were all from freshwater floods.
Wow. And of course, Ike is predicted to be a very slow-moving and large storm. And again, it's not so much the winds, but it is the storm surge and the tidal effects of the storm that authorities are really warning about. Carrie Emanuel, thank you very much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Carrie Emanuel is an atmospheric scientist and meteorologist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences. And now headlines from Femi Ok.
Thank you very much, John. It is 28 minutes past the hour. Let me just pick up where Carrie left off. And Hurricane Ike continues its relentless push towards Texas this hour. Authorities have urged residents in areas around Galveston to get out while they can. The National Weather Service says that Ike could be deadly. The storm is huge and could bring a 20-foot wall of water and 50-foot waves when it crashes ashore later today. A senior Western diplomat says talks with Russia have collapsed. A top EU body has been pushing to post international monitors inside two breakaway Georgian regions. Russia is saying no to that. And now that talks have broken down, it's not clear if the Kremlin will keep its promise to withdraw troops from the key areas inside Georgia later this month. Lehman Brothers, the country's fourth largest investment bank, is now up for sale. The firm's lost billions in the subprime crisis and announced more huge losses yesterday. And as share prices fell even more, the company put itself up on the market. No takers just yet, but the Bank of America is courting the floundering investment giant. And America's favorite cities have been polled by Travel and Leisure magazine. That's out right now. Las Vegas and New Orleans were number one for the wild weekend, Charleston, South Carolina, number one for the friendliest city, and Miami, number one for the most beautiful people.
I'm on my way down there now. Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer cash rewards to students for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it like merit bonuses in business? Viewpoints at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We asked you for songs that bring you out of bad times. We asked for you to give us songs not in the 70s and 80s, maybe something more recent. And, of course, you delivered.
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota. And the pick-me-up song that never fails me is You Get What You Give by the New Radicals. Please play it for your program today. That would just supremely launch my weekend. You got the music.
You get what you give. The new Radicals here on The Takeaway. Yes, that's our boy Troy in North Dakota. We got to get a theme song for Troy. Maybe that's his. You can send your song at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Okay, back to the news. After 7 weeks of talks in Zimbabwe and years of political tension, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai and President Robert Mugabe have reached what looks like a breakthrough power-sharing agreement. Joining us now is Hebson Mukwevesi. He's the Movement for Democratic Change's European spokesman. And, of course, the Movement for Democratic Change is the opposition party. That's Morgan Tsvangirai's party. He joins us from London for more details on this emerging power-sharing deal. Hebson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
First of all, this is a I was actually discussing what the agreement was seeming to move towards yesterday with someone from the BBC. It seems as though maybe this country is going to have two heads rather than one. Describe how this power sharing is going to work.
It's an agreement that was arrived at, after consultations with the three parties, political parties in Zimbabwe. And we hope that Zimbabweans will feel relieved now that there is going to be peace in the country and that the ruinous economy is going to be revived with the support from our international friends.
Clearly, the consensus among the people in Zimbabwe is to have peace and to have the economy move forward. But at some point, the official position of the opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, is that you folks won the election. You actually won the election the first time around. How do you continue working with Robert Mugabe when basically your party believes that it won the election?
To move forward, and we think Zimbabweans should be allowed to move forward. We have now decided that we should work together as one people and save lives, provide people with food, create jobs for the people of Zimbabwe. Zimbabweans will be pleased to know that their country will at last rejoin the international family.
Now, there's supposed to be a formal ceremony that will, at which point this agreement will be signed and the details will actually be worked out. Do you expect that Monday ceremony will take place?
Yes, it's going to take place on Monday at 10 o'clock Zimbabwean time. And over this weekend, the three parties would be working out the composition of the new government, but its priority would be to turn around the economy with food, with emphasis on food security. There's no doubt that the country will need huge foreign aid so that Zimbabweans can embark on a reconstruction program of their beautiful country. So, yes, come Monday, the signing ceremony will be held in Harare, and we hope that our regional and continental leaders will be present to witness this historical moment.
We're speaking with Hebson Mukwevesi, who's the Movement for Democratic Change's Europe spokesman. That's the opposition party of Morgan Tsvangirai, who's just announced an agreement for power sharing in Zimbabwe. You know, a lot of people, Hebson, suggested that after Morgan Tsvangirai pulled out of the runoff election because of the violence that was taking place, that Robert Mugabe really outplayed the opposition party in this chess game here. And I'm wondering if you're worried about the criticism that maybe by making a deal with Mugabe, you run the risk of being outfoxed again.
Well, Morgan Tsvangirai is a seasoned politician. He's Zimbabwe's most courageous and most popular politician. We are happy with the way things have developed in Zimbabwe, and now that we have got an agreement in place, we are not going to look back and say because of the 29th election, because of the 27 one-man presidential runoff, therefore Zimbabweans are going to remain enemies forever. We are saying yes, there were problems, people died, people were maimed, women were raped, properties were destroyed. But it's time for Zimbabweans to come together. It's time for Zimbabweans to accept that there is need for coexistence as political parties, and we'll move on, and the country will recover from this economic and social crisis.
And that's a message for all Zimbabweans, black and white?
That's the message to Zimbabweans, black and white. Zimbabwe is Zimbabwe for all people, regardless of color, creed, religion, or whatever color. Zimbabweans are Zimbabweans. We don't believe in on the basis of color. We are saying Zimbabweans for Zimbabweans, white, yellow, color.
No, very
is not important to us.
Hopeful, optimistic words from Ebson Mukwevezi. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ebson Mukwevezi is a spokesman for the Movement for Democratic Change, the Zimbabwean opposition party of Morgan Tsvangirai. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting some new wholesale price figures in. They've fallen by the largest amount in nearly 2 years as energy costs retreat. Sarah Palin couldn't quite define the Bush doctrine, but the Republican candidate for vice president was confident last night in her first television interview since she became the VP pick. Palin talked tough on Russia and Iran and held her own when questioned about her foreign policy experience. The Upper Texas coastline is battening down the hatches, or people are just leaving altogether. Slow-moving Hurricane Ike is headed towards the region, forcing the evacuation of a million people. But the hurricane, once it touches land, is expected to move through the area pretty quickly. The United Nations Children's Fund says that more than 9 million children died last year before reaching their fifth birthday. Experts say that while the mortality rate has declined in the last few decades, progress is still insufficient, particularly in Africa. Tensions are growing between the U.S. and two South African countries.
South African countries. I'm sorry, I had South Africa on the brain there, just listening to your
earlier interview. And, of course, Thabo Mbeki was the mediator for the Zimbabwe process. Did I dig myself out of that hole quick enough?
Great save. I'm going to put that on tape.
Nobody noticed that. Take two. Tensions are growing between the U.S. and two South American countries, Bolivia and Venezuela. After accusing the U.S. of encouraging anti-government protests, Bolivia kicked out the U.S. ambassador. In return, the U.S. threw out Bolivia's ambassador to Washington. And now Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has ordered out the U.S. ambassador to his country. It's like a regular soap opera.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Femi. Okay.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. 2.5 years ago, the country of Chile made history.
Hubo tiempos de nuestra historia en que nos dividimos entre unos y otros. Nos miramos con recelo, suspicacia, soberbia.
Chilean President Michelle Bachelet, speaking at her inauguration in 2006, talking about how the history of Chileans is one of division and mistrust. And some of that goes back to Chile's long, dark period 35 years ago, when thousands would die at the hands of a military government. In September 1973, socialist Salvador Allende was in his third year of his presidency. Allende won narrowly in a democratic election, the first Marxist to be elected president by popular vote in Latin America. He took the country to the left, nationalized private companies, instituted land reform, and made ties with communist nations. And his presidency was marked by spiraling inflation, food shortages, and violent strikes and demonstrations. An ambitious general saw an opening. His name, Augusto Pinochet. This is what followed.
Later news just in from Chile. A radio station says that guards at President Allende's palace in Santiago have surrendered, and rebel troops have given him only minutes in which to leave office.
La historia es nuestra, y la hacen los pueblos.
You're hearing the voice of Salvador Allende. I will pay with my life for the loyalty of the people, he said, and I say to you, they have the strength, but they will fail because they cannot stop the social process with crimes or force. History is ours, Allende said. It is made by the people. Allende didn't make it out of the presidential palace alive. The death was ruled a suicide. Pinochet's military junta was now in control, as one admiral boasted.
We don't like killing anybody. Our armed forces are for defense against enemies from abroad. not inside. And the other hand, there's not many example of countries getting rid of communism, so we are kind of a new experience, because if Spain got rid of communism, it was through a long war. For us, it only took us 6 hours.
Only 6 hours, perhaps because the coup reportedly had some important backers, which explains why. The U.S. government, in a press conference a year after the coup, President Gerald Ford denied helping Pinochet overthrow Allende.
Now, in this particular case, as I understand it, and there's no doubt in my mind, our government had no involvement whatsoever in the Allende coup. To my knowledge, no money has charged that. The facts are we had no involvement in any way whatsoever in the coup itself.
But documents that have come out over the years, including new ones this week, show private conversations between Kissinger and Richard Nixon about attempts to stop Allende from taking office and thwarting him once he did. Pinochet ruled Chile brutally for more than two decades. Thousands were murdered, tens of thousands more jailed, tortured, and exiled. Justice didn't catch up with Pinochet in time. He died in 2006, facing dozens of international charges and evading trial by citing his poor health. This week, Chileans look back. Here's Chilean Interior Minister José Miguel Insulza speaking yesterday.
Of course, everybody is sad when they remember the people who died on those days and the tremendous tragedy that followed and the dictatorship. And precisely what we've been working for is not to have this again.
In one of those ironies and narrative twists of history, 35 years later, Chile is led by another socialist, President Michelle Bachelet. As in Allende's words, history is ours. It is made by the people.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So have you noticed when the news gets really, really bad, the music on TV gets really, really bad. Television news uses music to evoke a mood, and we heard a lot of this kind of mood music, this sort of tragedy-inspired mood music on the anniversary of 9/11 this week. But great music can come out of tragedy. Often it inspires composers to create what really moves us. And all of this motivated our friend Terrence McKnight to join us this morning. He hosts a music program just down the hall from us here at WNYC. Terrence, you know good music. And you also know the sort of the history and the sort of mood and narratives that are tied up in a lot of the really most famous pieces of music. And I want to begin with Piano Concerto No. 2 of Rachmaninoff here. Let's just play a little bit, Dylan. This is a really famous piece. What was going on in Rachmaninoff's life before he wrote this?
This work, these notes that we're listening to, is a result of a guy who had such high expectations, and everybody had high expectations for him or from him because he was a child prodigy.
Right.
And went on to go to college at age 9 and graduated at 19. And his first symphony was such a flop that he left while the band was still playing.
Wow.
It was hard for him to show his face. It was hard for him to write music. He went almost 4 years without writing another piece, had to undergo psychotherapy. And through all of that, this is what he came out with.
Whoa.
After all, after those 4 years, this is the piece that he came out with. And I'll go on to say that part of the problem with his first symphony was not so much the music, but the conductor was supposedly on the podium drunk.
But that always is bad. Yeah.
And the orchestra was uninspired. Yeah.
But the symphony was a head piece. This is a heart piece. Let's move a little bit later in the concerto and tell us what's significant about this part here.
Well, you can see, you can hear in this music that Rachmaninoff has gotten his confidence back. I mean, the orchestra's going to join him in this big celebration. Yeah. So he's got his confidence back. He's at the piano. The orchestra is with him, and this actually became a pop song.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's a Barry Manilow tune, right?
Full Moon and Empty Arms, something like that. Yeah.
We will spare our audience by not playing the.
And we won't sing it either.
Right. We won't sing it either. Right. Oh, it's a great tune. But fade that down for a second. I just want to take 2 seconds and say, you know, when I lost a girlfriend one time before I got married, there was nothing that would help me except for this song here. This song, Disney tune, Beauty and the Beast. I would get drunk and listen to this song and weep. And that's enough of that. Why does that work, Terrence?
Well,
why does that stuff
obviously
work?
Obviously, you were the beauty, John.
Right. But we use, I mean, we embrace music, even bad music, to just get us through these rough times. And it's amazing how emotionally charged music can be.
Well, and that's why I brought you these examples, because, John, we have to know that there are some people out there lonely. I mean, if you go to Craigslist and look at personals, you'll see how many lonely people there are out there, as well as other personals. And, you know, people are having hard times with, you know, all that's going on. So music,
let's hear a peep of this Aretha Franklin that you played a moment ago, Dylan.
Another source of comfort. Yeah. Now, this is a little more direct than the Rachmaninoff. In trouble.
You need some love and
care. That is so great.
Ain't nothing going right. Woo.
Now, what she's setting up here, John, is a piece by Thomas Dorsey written in 1932, a tune called Precious Lord. Here, Thomas Dorsey, another guy similar to Rachmaninoff. He was very talented. He had a troubled kind of a childhood, dropped out of school, moved to Chicago, and started studying music. Well, he had started studying music when he was in Atlanta, but he studied music in Chicago and went on to become the father of gospel music. He started working with singers like Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey, Mahalia Jackson. And in the midst of all of that, he had a nervous breakdown, and he decided that he was not going to write blues anymore, that he was going to write religious music, spiritual music, gospel music. And his wife and his child died during childbirth, and he wrote a tune called his very, you hear it right here, Precious Lord, Take My Hand.
Well, I feel
400 compositions this guy composed, but this is probably
this is the one.
Well,
you chose an amazing tune that I've known for a long time, Oliver Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time, which was written under some also pretty amazing circumstances of history.
8 years later. Olivier Messiaen, French composer who joined the French army. He wanted to fight, but he had bad eyesight. Right. And so he became like a medical orderly. Well, he was captured by the Germans, sent to a prison camp, and found other musicians in the prison camp. And when they found Messiaen, he didn't have like a syringe or bandages. He had musical scores on him. And
I understand the instrumentation in this quartet is just what was available at the POW camp.
Right. He found a cellist, he found a violinist, he found a clarinetist, and he was a pianist. So he put together this piece called Quartet for the End of Time, and these POWs performed this piece in front of a few hundred guards and other prisoners of war in 1941.
Wow. You know, lastly, and I could go for another hour with you, but we have Shostakovich, Symphony No. 7. There's nobody more brooding than Shostakovich. Take us out with this.
1941, his city, Leningrad, was being invaded by the Germans. Shostakovich wrote this four-movement piece. Millions, nearly a million people in Leningrad had been killed because of starvation, because of air raids, and Shostakovich stayed around, and he wrote this symphony with all of that stuff going on. He stayed in the city, wrote this symphony. He called the last movement Victory initially, and you get a sense that the victory doesn't come immediately, but you have to wait for it. You hear brooding, building up.
Wow. Terrence, you are the beauty. I am the beast. Thanks for joining us today on The Takeaway. I hear victory. Ooh, thanks to Rachmaninoff and to Terrence McKnight, our buddy here at WNYC Radio. Because we want to hear, we don't expect you to follow that, but we do want your songs, the songs that bring you out of a slump. And we asked to get out of the 70s and 80s, and you did, just in the wrong direction.
This is Bob from the East Village. My song is Good Day Sunshine by the Beatles. That's not 70s and 80s. That's 60s.
Good day sunshine. Good day sunshine. Good day sunshine.
Oh, can't go wrong with Beatles. Here's another one.
Hi, my name is Marty. I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts. You've Got a Friend by Carol King, sung by Carol King. Or James Taylor. That's the song.
You got a friend. You've got yourself a friend now.
Hey now, baby.
To the question, what songs bring me comfort in hard times? My answer, Aquarius. The dawning of the new age.
And for some of you, maybe more liberal-minded, Governor Palin was an inspiration.
It's Mark from White Plains calling about a song I'd like to hear. After listening to Sarah Palin and hearing about a storm slamming into Port Arthur, Texas, I'd like to hear a song from a woman who's really speaking from her heart. How about Janis Joplin asking for a Mercedes-Benz?
A Mercedes-Benz. My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends.
All right, we got one last one here, Dylan. Can you get this one? This is for my friend Femi, okay?
So, oh Lord, won't you buy me?
What a wonderful frame.
How you feeling?
Thank you. It means no worries in Swahili. That's what we need to go out on.
Well, actually, let's go out on the latest from Hurricane Ike really quickly.
Category 2 storm, 105 miles an hour. National Weather Service says you need to be out of the way in Galveston.
That's John. The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
We go now live to the secret backroom negotiations between NBC Universal and iTunes on downloading programming content.
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale, and I won't have it! Is that clear? You think you merely stopped a business deal? That is not the case.
Okay, it probably wasn't as dramatic as the 70s movie network, but the business model of the TV networks is radically changing. After years of fighting the internet, NBC is joining it. Why? TV's mad as hell and not going to take it anymore on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, September 12th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. the latest on Hurricane Ike, the beauty of experimental science, that's what we're doing today, what we know and don't know about the governor of Alaska, and a boatload of pennant parables. The baseball season is going out like a lion. Those stories and more, but first, some headlines. Stocks are looking at a lower open today as traders wait to hear what the future holds for embattled finance giant Lehman Brothers. The nation's fourth largest investment bank finally put itself up for sale yesterday. Hurricane Ike is set to hit Texas later today or tomorrow with devastating force. A Category 2 storm. Texas Governor Rick Perry is warning residents in the danger zone to get out of the way while they can.
I cannot overemphasize the danger that is facing us. It's going to do some substantial damage.
Governor of Alaska Sarah Palin's first interview since she became John McCain's running mate aired last night on ABC. She was met and asked questions from Charlie Gibson of ABC.
You can't blink. You have to be wired in a way of being so committed to the mission that we're on, reform of this country and victory in the war.
Palin confidently pushed aside questions about her inexperience. General David Petraeus, the outgoing commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, says he may never use the word victory to describe the situation in that country. He gave an interview to the BBC, his last, before becoming the commander of CENTCOM. What am I missing, Femi? Okay.
Hello there, John. Just got this news in the last 60 minutes or so. Retail sales have dropped unexpectedly last month. The Commerce Department says that numbers are down by 0.3%. Economists were expecting the reverse. They predicted a 0.3 rise in sales.
Got to be because of energy, right?
Absolutely. And a big day for Zimbabwe. Last night, President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai finally reached a power-sharing agreement. It's taken almost 2 months. And Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has kicked out the UN ambassador to his country. It's the latest move in rising tensions between the U.S. and the South American countries Venezuela and Bolivia.
And let's go out on politics. What's going on today?
Barack Obama is campaigning in New Hampshire. John McCain is making the rounds on TV. He's appearing with his wife Cindy on The View and Rachel Ray.
The View and Rachel Ray. Well, that's a busy day for the McCains. When all else fails, there's music. That's what we're talking about on the show today. What is the mood-changing music that you listen to when times are tough? The song that brings you around, that you never fail on. We're also talking about the Sarah Palin interview with Charles Gibson there. What did you take away from the interview? What do you think the governor of Alaska and running mate of John McCain should be asked and wasn't? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. Responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As we mentioned, Hurricane Ike is bearing down on the Texas coast. Galveston, Texas residents have been told they face certain death if they don't evacuate. Top winds are near 105 miles an hour. Forecasters say it could strengthen. Joining us once again is Paul Pendergraf, senior producer for news and public affairs at KUHF, Houston Public Radio. Paul, thanks for being with us.
No problem, John. How you doing?
Great. Let's talk about the infrastructure there in Houston with Katrina and New Orleans. Of course, there are all these complicated levees that if they burst, there would be additional flooding. It's not the same situation in Houston, but you are looking at some troublesome infrastructure there. Explain.
Well, the city of Houston is a gigantic city. It's 600 square miles, so it's a monstrous city, but it sits about 60 feet off of the sea level, and it's about 40 to 50 miles inland, and it's very flat. As you know, you've got relatives here. The problem we've got when we've got heavy rains and storms like this, we flood. There's very few places for the water to go. We have natural bayous, and we have man-made bayous that are designed to drain, and they work pretty well. But this is the system's going to be inundated tonight. We've already seen some of the surge actually hitting the coast, but we're going to be inundated tonight with a storm surge up in Galveston Bay in excess of 15 or 16 feet. That's going to be in more water in the bay than it's had in a while, and any inland rain that would normally drain there will be dammed up. So there's going to be some lowland flooding, no question.
Well, let's talk about residential infrastructure. Houston, for those who haven't been there, is, as you said, a flat geographic area, but also there isn't the sort of concentration of buildings like you might find in a city in the east. There's enormous stretches of low, one and two story buildings all over the area. What's most threatened, do you think, at this point?
Well, the way that the path of this storm is forecasted, it's, I don't know if you're familiar, your listeners may be familiar with Houston, but Galveston's on the coast, and I-45 comes right straight up from the coast into the central city of Houston. The storm is going to track right straight up I-45, and that takes it right into the central business district. When we had a storm much like this in 1983 with Hurricane Alicia, we had thousands of panes of glass from some of these high-rise office towers that were shattered, and shards of glass were floating down and crashing onto the street below. The city of Houston, the Houston Police Department, had to literally block off about 30 square blocks of downtown to prevent people from going in there.
Wow.
Because glass was, I mean, this was really a scary thing.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of those buildings have been upgraded and updated since in the last 25 years, but that was an experience that changed a lot of people's belief that, you know, hurricanes can really create havoc.
Well, Paul, before we go, you know, we haven't mentioned Galveston, and the people of Galveston, of course, absorbed the mother of all storms and the worst weather-related disaster in U.S. history. How are they feeling at this point?
Well, there's some panic down there, I have to admit. There's been some people that used to say, oh, I'll live through this one, I'll live through them all. They're now trying to get, of course, they called the evacuations on yesterday, but there are people that are still trying to get off this morning because this morning, before the storm surge has even arrived, that 17-foot seawall at Galveston is already seeing a significant amount of water that's breaching over it. If there's a 20 or 22-foot storm surge, Galveston Island, which is a barrier island, could be inundated and the bay's going to fill up. I mean, there could be serious damage and a lot of death on the island of Galveston. There won't be 6,000 or 12,000 like 1900, but there could be dozens of deaths. You know, that's certainly possible.
Well, some sobering thoughts as we think about landfall sometime tomorrow. Paul Pendergraf, Senior Producer for News and Public Affairs at KUHF Houston Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Sarah Palin, to shift gears here, has the credentials to be president, she says in her first television interview since John McCain chose her as his running mate. The Republican vice presidential candidate said her qualifications are about reform of government and putting government back on the side of people. David Mark is a senior political editor at Politico.com. David, there's been a suspicion that the McCain campaign has been kind of rationing press access to Sarah Palin, but this interview was a face-to-face, no-holds-barred interview with Charlie Gibson of ABC. What have you learned about her, or what still remains unknown about Sarah Palin?
Well, I think what we learned is that she is a headstrong person. She is somebody that does not lack confidence. It was clear in her convention acceptance speech, in the limited public appearances she's had so far. And she said she wants to get across the point that she's ready to take over as vice president and potentially president if need be. And voters will see if they agree with that sentiment or not.
We got a sense of her sort of tactical echoes, I suppose, of the themes of John McCain. I mean, certainly one of John McCain's challenges, and you've talked about this before, is the need to distance himself from President Bush without repudiating the entire Republican agenda. Here's Sarah Palin addressing a question about what she thinks of the Bush doctrine.
I believe that what President Bush has attempted to do is rid this world of Islamic extremism, terrorists who are hell-bent on destroying our nation. There have been blunders along the way, though.
So she distances but supports the general scheme of President Bush. How do you think she handled that?
That's probably about as good as she could do. That is, as you say, that is almost exactly in line with what John McCain's been saying for the last several years. I'm not sure a lot of voters are necessarily going to buy that sentiment because it still leaves a lot of questions about preemptive invasions like Iraq and other such situations. So there's a lot more debate there, a lot more fodder for debate, but I think she handled it about as well as she could have.
And Charlie Gibson was pretty tough with her there, but let's move on to an issue that John McCain doesn't talk about much at all. Here's Palin being asked about a comment that's appeared widely on the Internet regarding the mission in Iraq being some sort of task that is from God. Here's her answer.
The reference there is a repeat of Abraham Lincoln's words when he said, first he suggested, never presume to know what God's will is. And I would never presume to know God's will or to speak God's words. But what Abraham Lincoln had said, and that's a repeat in my comments, was, let us not pray that God is on our side in a war or any other time, but let us pray that we are on God's side.
All right, here's a multiple choice, Mark. Was that candid? Was that an elaboration, or was that a sidestep?
I'd say sidestep, the last one. That is very treacherous ground for politicians to be walking on. President Bush, of course, was accused of kind of a messianism or shortly after 9/11 and saying he had God on his side or whatever the quote was. And I think that's something that the McCain-Palin campaign would rather move away from as quickly as possible.
Well, it's probably going to come back if she has more access to the press, and more about that will be on other ABC programs over the next couple of days. When asked about national security, she took a curious tack. She focused on her experience with the dealing with energy. Here's what she said there.
I want you to not lose sight of the fact that energy is a foundation of national security. It's that important. It's that significant.
I mean, they're betting there that most Americans, you know, really don't care about foreign affairs in the details, but are focused on energy and know about Middle East oil and that sort of thing. Are they right?
Yeah. Well, that's a kind of a complicated argument. There may be some merit to what she's saying, but she really has not dealt with geopolitical issues the way that it's being discussed in this campaign. So I would expect she's going to get pressed about that a lot more. And I would also expect the Obama campaign will see that as a weak sign and try and hone in on that a little bit more.
All right. Well, before we go, can you just generally sort of sum up your sense of what we still need to know about Sarah Palin, or you know, are we pretty? Do we have a much more complete picture now?
I think we have the start of a picture, but there is a whole lot more to ask. There's much more about foreign affairs. She referenced making the country of Georgia a member of NATO, which of course would have policy problems with Russia, as we all know. There's a lot more specific foreign affairs issues. And I think the Obama campaign probably saw some areas of weakness that they can go after here. And the press, too, just doing our jobs. There's a lot more questions to ask.
But, I mean, were you like dying to know what Dan Quayle thought of Georgia? I mean, what's different about Sarah Palin here? I mean, do we really need to know her foreign policy experience? Or is she just getting hosed because she's a woman and she's really self-confident and she's really drawn a line in the sand?
I don't think it's a woman thing. I think it would be the same questions for any vice presidential candidate. I don't think it's about specific answers to policy questions. It's whether it's a threshold question. Does she have the broad grasp of geopolitics to take over as commander-in-chief if necessary? Maybe so. Maybe voters will decide that she does. It's just there's a lot of unanswered questions still.
David Marks, senior editor for Politico.com, watching the Sarah Palin interview on ABC last night, and he's not the only one.
Yes, Ian from Brooklyn, New York. My take on the Sarah Palin interview last night, I thought Charlie Gibson was kind of giving her a lot of I got you questions and also looking down on her like, you know, you're not qualified.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We have an informative conversation about the radically changing business model in television coming up. But first, we have a lot of responses from you on Sarah Palin, the interview last night at ABC. What questions do you think she should be asked? Sarah says to us, I would appreciate it if Sarah Palin would make her personal finances public and answer the following questions. How much of the federal appropriations received by the community of Wasilla, where she's mayor, were distributed to her profit for-profit entities owned by Sarah Palin and or related parties? Great question. Two, how much of Sarah Palin and or related parties' fortunes have been made at the expense of the American taxpayer? On Palin, Mona sends us an email. I enjoy your show, but I resent your implying that Hillary supporters are embracing Sarah Palin en masse. I'm a Democratic working woman, and I don't, as you suggested on yesterday's show, admire Sarah Palin. I found her vicious, fanatical, and not particularly intelligent. My take at the takeaway. For more responses, 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's how to reach us. Anyway, NBC shows like The Office and Heroes are now back on sale at the iTunes store. Haven't been available for nearly a year after NBC balked at the pricing. It's a significant deal for the two companies, Apple and NBC Universal, but it's even bigger deal for the future of television on the Internet. Nancy Miller is a senior editor for Wired Magazine. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And, you know, let's talk about the significance of this deal. You know, Jeff Zucker was all over, the president of NBC Universal was all over talking about how, you know, what we want is our content to be on all platforms after years of saying just the opposite. What's going on here, do you think?
You know, it's funny. I was at the keynote conversation with Steve Jobs when he announced this, and everybody gasped in the audience.
Really?
I think people were really surprised that NBC was coming back to iTunes, but... the market has spoken. iTunes has a huge, huge revenue base for NBC. So they kind of, you know, made a good move in coming back.
You know, NBC has described itself as a content company, also a marketing company. And it seems that this new Internet strategy is about using the Internet to market content and using, you know, institutions like Google to actually help broker its ad sales. I mean, this is a real change in the interactivity between television networks and the Internet. What's going on here way beyond NBC?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, with NBC alone, they had a partnership with Fox with Hulu, and they are working with Google on monitoring ads for ad revenue. I'm not sure what you mean by more than NBC, but...
it seems to me that the biggest, you know, one of the biggest networks, certainly, you know, GE, the giant company GE, has decided to make a bet that putting your content everywhere actually floats all boats. And, you know, Jeff Zucker yesterday didn't seem to be concerned at all about losing the free content sites like Hulu, even though they were going on to iTunes.
Well, you know, free is one thing. I mean, they are putting their content on Hulu, but they're generating advertising revenue from that. So they're looking at a couple of different models. A year ago, NBC, along with a lot of other TV networks, were obsessed with piracy. That seems to have gone away in the last year. You're absolutely right, where they do want a multi-platform opportunity. They want to be able to have their stuff seen everywhere. But it's based on a few different models. With iTunes, it was the a la carte. It was a pay-per-click. You could download it for $1.99. Now they want to do another model, which is advertising. With Amazon Unbox, which is something that they also tried, it was a subscription base. So it's looking at a variety of different business models in order to generate revenue.
You know, remember the old days when analysts would get on television and say it's either going to be a subscription model or it's going to be an advertising model? What NBC seems to be saying here is there are people who like to buy on iTunes because they're iTunes people, and then there are people who like to go to the card table, you know, down in Times Square and buy it from the, you know, Chinese guys selling the pirated stuff. There's a different market for all these distribution models.
Well, it seems like that right now. You know, it's funny, at Wired we talk about that a lot. In fact, we used to speak about it in this way. What's going to win out, the ad model, the subscription model, or the a la carte model?
The answer is yes. They all are.
As absolutely. And I think that NBC and other networks are exploring that in a way they haven't necessarily before. You probably know this, but in the TV upfronts, a lot of the advertising that was generated was done in these packages, these bundles. So that was not only just the TV advertising, but also NBC was offering their advertisers opportunities online. So there was a lot of these bundle packages that generated a lot of revenue for the networks, and maybe in a way they hadn't seen before.
And that was actually one of the headlines out of the Olympics. I mean, NBC used the Olympics and all the sort of flow-through on the Internet sites where you could see the Olympics to sell ad packages all the way through. I mean, they actually created new advertising products that never existed before. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the role of NBC seems so, their emphasis on DRM, you know, digital rights management, their fear of piracy, and their obsession with Apple, the way that they ran their profit margins of not charging enough for their shows, that seems to have gone away. I mean, but think about this. I mean, Apple announced that they're going to charge a dollar more for HDTV. So now they have a high def feature on iTunes, so you can see, you know, The Office on your Nano and high def. So that's actually an extra dollar that iTunes can be charging that maybe appealed to NBC.
So have you downloaded all the episodes of 30 Rock yet?
It's funny that you say that. I'm still. You can actually. I watch Hulu for 30 Rock as much as I can. I also DVR 30 Rock when I can. That's my absolute favorite show. So I'll take that show anywhere I can get it.
She'll take it wherever she can get it. Nancy Miller is a senior editor for Wired Magazine. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. Lehman Brothers, the country's fourth largest investment bank, is up for sale. The firm lost billions in the subprime crisis and announced more huge losses yesterday. No buyers yet, but Bank of America is courting the floundering investment giant. Hurricane Ike is heading towards Galveston, Texas. Authorities have issued dire warnings. They say that residents in low-lying coastal areas face certain death if they try to ride out the storm at home. Ike is a Category 2 hurricane, but it's huge. It actually fills pretty much the entire Gulf of Mexico. It will make landfall sometime tonight or early tomorrow. A senior Western diplomat says that talks with Russia have collapsed. A top EU body has been pushing to post international monitors inside two breakaway Georgian regions, but Russia's refusing to allow it. Now that talks have broken down, it's not clear if the Kremlin will keep its promise to withdraw troops from key areas inside Georgia later this month. And the governing party in Thailand has withdrawn the nomination of Sumuk Sundavej as its candidate for prime minister. He had been renominated after he was kicked out for hosting a cooking show while in office. Now he's out for sure. The ruling coalition will hold elections for a new prime minister next week. And Pope Benedict has arrived in France. It's his first visit to the country since he took office. France has strict laws on keeping public life secular. The Pope is due to give a speech during his stay about the role of religion in society. That's a look at your news from around the world.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer cash rewards to students for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it like merit bonuses in business? Viewpoints at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Last night, I'm sure some of you saw it, Sarah Palin gave an exclusive interview to ABC's Charlie Gibson. What did you take away from it?
Good morning. This is Chris from Brooklyn. Regarding Sarah Palin, I was shocked that she did not know what the Bush Doctrine was. It is part of the reason why her son was being deployed. And I cannot believe that somebody aspiring to the office of vice president under a 72-year-old man with health problems doesn't understand this stuff or doesn't know this stuff.
What did you think? What does Sarah Palin need to be asked? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. It's Friday, with only 17 games left in the regular season, the Red Sox face an uphill battle to win the AL East. They lost 2 of 3 to division-leading Tampa Bay this week, which is the story of the baseball season. Boston is 2.5 games behind the Rays, who open a weekend series tonight against the Yankees, who look to be out of it. But there's a lot going on in the baseball season, and Dave Zirin joins us now from outside of Washington, D.C., sports writer for The Nation. Dave, that's your theme music. What do you think?
I love it.
You love it?
I love it. I'm here throwing punches and shadow boxing. It's amazing.
All right, that's nice. So you're flacking a book. You come to the studio, no book. You're on the phone. Okay, message received, Dave.
Yeah, that's about right.
All right. So, Babe, what's going on? You said the Rays were the story, the amazing story. I mean, they had such a week. Describe to me the moments, the baseball moments that the Rays have experienced just in this week.
Oh, it's remarkable. And first of all, just so in case you have some casual baseball fans, yes, before this season they were known as the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. This year they are just known as the Tampa Bay Rays. And I think we're all seeing the advantages of renouncing Satan on your record.
Yes,
they're doing
indeed.
A great job this year.
And they're a young team. They're a low-paid team. Nothing like the Red Sox or the Yankees.
Yeah, nothing. But this is, this is the fruits of what happens when you're the worst-run baseball franchise for a decade. I mean, the Tampa Bay Rays have been absolutely terrible their first 10 years of existence, but in the process what they've been able to do is stockpile an astounding amount of fantastic young talent, and if you couple that with some really good trades, then for the young baseball fan, people like Evan Longoria and Scott Kazmaier, I mean, these are the names of the future.
Oh, well, they're certainly the names of the present. And speaking of Cinderella stories, I mean, we can drag the tiredest, oldest Cinderella story in baseball is the Chicago Cubs. Here they are.
That's true, and I'm just back from Chicago. And let me just say, I've never seen a city of fans where people act like they're in a chair that's tipping over and that somebody is about to just knock them right down to the floor. I mean, the Chicago Cubs, they have been leading their division all season. They've had a terrible week this week, but then again, everyone else in their division has had a terrible week as well. And it's just a whole fan base that seems to be waiting for the other shoe to drop, waiting for the Steve Bartmans of the world. He was the guy in 03, of course, who messed up the team when they looked like they were making it to the World Series by grabbing the ball away from Moises Alou in the playoffs. So,
hey, Dave, I was there in 84 when the Cubs made the playoffs and then lost 4 straight to the Padres. So, the Chicago, it's not over till it's over in Chicago.
Yeah. It's not over till it's over, but it's a bad feeling when people feel like it's over before it's even begun.
Yeah, that's true. So what other, the Minnesota Twins are a smidge away from the White Sox in the AL Central, and the Dodgers could actually make it here.
Yeah, I mean, the Dodgers are a good story as well because they brought in Manny Ramirez. And I'm speaking this for the casual fan out there who's listening. Manny Ramirez, if you don't know him, he's kind of like the Rain Man of hitters, Manny being Manny. They call him the hitter savant. He walks up in the batter's box, and before you know it, he's just lacing line drives left and right. Bringing in Manny Ramirez has changed the attitude of the owner, Frank McCourt, who is going to fire their general manager by the end of this year. It's changed the attitude of the clubhouse, and it's making Joe Torre, I know New York fans remember Joe Torre, manager of the Dodgers, who's the sleepy-eyed genius, is starting to look like a genius once again.
Well, I think for New York fans, all the pain of the Yankees, and what of that pain is not assuaged by the Mets, who look like they're going to make the playoffs, although, they had such a collapse last year. New Yorkers are going to love Torre in the postseason. Talk about the Mets for a minute. You're a Mets fan, right?
I'm a Mets fan. You know that.
Yep.
I was raised in the 1980s in New York City. I mean, I practically have an orange NY tattooed on my back. My mom wouldn't let me do that, but still, I would have.
It's a lot of information there, Dave.
A little too much info.
A little bit, yeah.
But Carlos Delgado, out of nowhere, one of those baseball players who's older than I am. And every time a player is now older than me, I'm now old enough that I'm thinking to myself, maybe they should be thinking about other work. But Carlos Delgado, he spent the last 2 months of this season looking like an MVP candidate after spending the last 2 years looking like he was really out of it and really couldn't play anymore.
But they lost Wagner. They don't have a closer.
No, they've lost Wagner, and they've blown more saves in the second half of this season than every other division leader combined. It's an amazing statistic.
So you want to handicap the series at this point, or just do the playoffs?
Oh, I'd like to handicap the series. I mean, I'll tell you this. This is what I said at the halfway point of the season, and I'd like to stick with it. At the halfway point of the season, actually at the start of the season, I predicted Angels-Mets, and that's looking very good. I know, and when I say Mets, I'm a ridiculous homer. But at the halfway point of the season, I said Rays-Mets, and I'm starting to feel that that's looking very right.
No, I'd prefer Rays-Mets. Dave Zirin, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my privilege. Thanks so much.
Dave Zirin, there's his theme song, sports writer for The Nation and author of the new book, A People's History of Sports in the United States. Gary Glitta. Our own Femi Glitta. Femi, okay with the headlines?
Thank you very much. Does Dave get some cheerleaders as well? That music kind of demands it, doesn't it, really?
Sure does.
21 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. A confident Sarah Palin says that she's ready to lead as John McCain's vice president. In her first television interview since being selected by the Republican Party, Palin talked tough about Russia and Iran, but looked a little nervous when asked probing questions about her lack of foreign policy experience. Hurricane Ike covers a huge 40% of the Gulf of Mexico, and terrified residents of the Texas coast are fleeing before the storm hits. Forecasters warn that Ike could cause a wall of 20 feet high in coastal areas. That's a surge which is brought on by the actual force of the storm making it on land. The storm is expected to make landfall this evening or tomorrow morning. The weather will already be beginning to deteriorate. 1 million people have been ordered to leave the Gulf. Category 2 Hurricane Ike, but very dangerous indeed. A diplomatic spat is escalating between the United States and Bolivia and Venezuela. The Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, ordered the expulsion of the U.S. ambassador to Venezuela after Bolivia and the United States threw out each other's ambassadors. The Bolivian government accuses the U.S. of encouraging anti-government protests. And more between Russia and Georgia. Russia is balking at the prospect of 80 extra monitors in the breakaway Georgian provinces of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Russia and Georgia went to war last month, and the West is questioning whether Russia really intends to draw down its forces in Georgia. And a quick look at the Paralympic Games currently taking place in Beijing, in China. As far as the medals tables are concerned, China is first, Great Britain is second, and the U.S. is a little behind in third place.
China is really cleaning up. Thanks for your Paralympic coverage there.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Another day, another seesaw of volatility on Wall Street. The markets have been open for just a little over 10 minutes. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is already down almost 120 points. The NASDAQ is down 21 points, and the S&P is down a solid 1%. But on the minds of everybody on Wall Street is the fate of Lehman Brothers. After looking for someone to buy assets of the company, it's sort of thrown in the towel and decided to find somebody to buy the whole company. Lehman Brothers, the fourth largest investment bank in the United States, to lose it, for it to go out of business, would be a very significant development. And joining us to discuss it is Peter Morici. He's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Business and former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission. Peter, this is a really big deal. What do you think the chances are that Lehman's going to find a buyer?
Well, it's going to be difficult for them to find a buyer. Likely there isn't much value left in the company. What happened yesterday is they announced that they would sell off their bad real estate assets, write down the loans and take the write-downs on the properties and so forth. And to compensate for that, they would sell their very attractive wealth management business, the Neuberger Berman mutual fund business and wealth management for wealthy people. Strip that all away, and you're back to what Lehman Brothers was 10, 15, 20 years ago, a basic investment bank. The trouble is, over the years, they've learned to pay themselves very, very well. The managers have stripped away all the capital in the form of big bonuses and high pay, and the company, and they've lost their credibility, which is the most important thing in the old investment banking business, the trust of the client. The company is not worth very much. No one trusts the CEO. It's really time for plywood and nails. Board up the windows and send the executives home.
Peter, you make a really important point here, because this is the strategic trend in almost all the investment banks, the high bonuses, pulling the capital out of the traditional sort of partnership arrangements that used to be the old J.P. Morgan back when it was in a two-story building on Wall Street. This is a bad sign for all the investment banks, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think all the way on up to Citigroup, the largest of our financial institutions, which, by the way, is both a bank and an investment bank, they're selling off assets to essentially pay outrageous compensation structures. It's kind of like the Florida Marlins taking on the payroll of the New York Yankees to win a pennant. But yet they finished last, so what is the team worth? It's not worth anything.
I know you'd get around to baseball at some point. Lehman Brothers stock is still trading at this moment, and it's down about 12%. Quick response to the retail sales figures. The PPI fell much more than was expected. Energy seems to be the issue. What do you think?
Well, frankly, folks are scared. Their housing values are falling. They're reading about a very troubled stock market and a very troubled banking system. Americans are getting this sinking feeling that this new economy we heard so much about in the 90s, and we had the Enron fallout and the accounting failures in our companies, that the other shoe is now falling. One of the great backbones of America has been its financial institutions, and they are failing. That is frightening people. That, along with the high price of gasoline, is taking money out of their pocket. They simply don't have it to spend.
So even though the inflation number is positive, it's mostly a sign of a slowdown in the economy and a sense of fear among consumers and asset holders throughout the economy. That is a great takeaway. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I hope to see you again.
Sure. We'll be on the horn with you again, I'm sure. Wall Street, again, doing very, very poorly this morning. That's Peter Morici, who's a professor at the Maryland School of Business and former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Femi Okay with the headlines. That's how we begin.
Hi there, John. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Gasoline prices are rising over concerns about cuts in supply because of Hurricane Ike. The hurricane is churning towards the petroleum refineries along the Gulf Coast, and many companies are stopping operations at refineries in Texas, mostly in the Houston area. Nearly 1 million people along the coast have been ordered to evacuate. Stock futures have declined following a weaker-than-expected report on retail sales. The government's report that retail sales fell 0.3% in August is adding to Wall Street's list of concerns about the economy.
Actually, the market's open. I mean, the stocks are way down this morning.
Yeah.
Dow's down 120.
Thanks, John. That's the update. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is leaving open the option of a war with Russia if it were to invade Georgia and if the Republic were a NATO ally. In her first televised interview since being tapped as John McCain's running mate, Palin said that when you are a NATO ally in another country and if another country is attacking you, you're going to be expected to be called upon and help. Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin says that Georgia deserves to be punched in the face after it attacked South Ossetia last month. Mr. Putin rejected criticism that Russia used overwhelming force when it invaded Georgia. The brief war inflamed tensions between Russia and the West. And finally, a story from our colleagues at the BBC. They're reporting on news about kosher and non-kosher music. Now, in Israel, the ultra-Orthodox organization called the Committee of Jewish Music has put together a blacklist of music that you shouldn't play at your ultra-Orthodox wedding or public events because it's considered to be decadent. So here's some kosher music. And here's one of the pieces of music on the blacklist. This is non-kosher music. So sort of like Fiddler on the Roof on speed. Quite like it, actually. And Rabbi Luft, who put together the blacklist of music for non-kosher music, says that kosher music has to have instruments and beats and melody and shouldn't use any modern instrumentation.
Well, knowing my Israeli friends, they'll probably send the sales of the non-kosher through the roof. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
So Adore Udoji is away, but she'll be back on Monday, and we're looking forward to that. But all this morning, we've been asking what songs get you through hard times. No more calls. We have a winner.
Hi, my name is Bill. I'm calling from New Jersey. The song that I always listen to that gets me back up, and I don't know the name of who produced it, but it's an English band with kind of a punk rock feel, and they all sing, "I Get Knocked Down."
We have a winner, Tub Thumping by Chumbawamba. Here's another song to add to your playlist. Carrie from Long Island City, New York, emailed us. Guaranteed to get your blood flowing, no matter how deep your funk or broke your heart. The Skin of My Yellow Country Teeth by Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. Okay, 877-MY-TAKE for more songs or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. All right, if you've been paying attention to the news, you know about the 17-mile-long particle-smashing Large Hadron Collider under the border of Switzerland and France. It's a multi-billion-dollar science project supposed to give us new insights into the nature of the early universe, but it's a classic story. Scientists put together a machine to test something out, and they switch it on. It's a great storyline for Robert Crease, who's the author of The Prism and the Pendulum, the 10 most beautiful experiments in science. He's also the chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Stony Brook University. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, John.
I'm good so to excited to have you, because when they switched that machine on, I just thought of all the science fair projects and all the people who've, you know, built these little boxes that are supposed to do this or that. I mean, there's a classic kind of sense of joy about switching on an experiment that goes way back to the early days of science.
Yes, you can't. It's something familiar to every science student, every science, every high school student, as you said, who's built and got an experiment to work, and it's working the way it should, and you feel that it's a beautiful thing.
Part of it is designing the experiment that's actually going to show or test the proposition that you want tested. There's a beauty in that, and then part of it is actually building the machine itself. What are the 10 most beautiful experiments in science?
Well, I'm also a columnist for the magazine Physics World.
Sure.
And a few years ago, I was interested by the fact that scientists often use the word beauty a lot. It's a beautiful experiment, a beautiful result, and I was wondering whether this was just a metaphorical use of the word beauty, or whether there was something more to it. So I asked scientists to give me lists of their most beautiful experiments, and I compiled a list of the 10 most beautiful from that. Hundreds of people responded.
And what was the top of the list?
Well, the first one, in chronological order, the most beautiful experiment was Eratosthenes' experiment to determine the circumference of the Earth. Eratosthenes was a Greek who lived in the 3rd century B.C., and with just a sundial and a measuring stick and elementary geometry, he lived just a little bit after Euclid, he was able to determine the circumference of the Earth. Now, think about that. That's using something as ephemeral as shadows,
right,
in order to determine something on a huge scale, something on a tiny scale to determine the dimensions of the world.
He uses the sundial to detect the curvature of the Earth and then calculates from the curvature what the circumference or the radius or, you know, might be, right?
Yeah, use the fraction of the shadow with respect to the circle of the sundial is the same as the fraction between where he was measuring and a place where the shadow of the where the sun was directly over the Earth to the dimension of the Earth itself. And he came up with a figure that was very close to the right figure.
So what's a more modern experiment that passes the beauty test here?
Well, the most beautiful experiment, according to my respondents, was an experiment that shows that quantum mechanics really is mysterious. That is, that things down there don't behave the way that things do up here.
Is the God actually does play dice, Einstein disappointment, you know, where he thought actually quantum mechanics couldn't be true, but this proved that in fact it is pretty strange.
Yes, an electron can pass through two different places at once. It can travel through a tiny slit and two tiny slits simultaneously.
And how did a machine prove that without getting too technical?
You know that there's something called an interference pattern that's right. made when objects travel through it, like a wave travels through two slits. There's a particular kind of pattern that's created on the other side. And what this experiment did, and it was done by a group of Italians in 1974 and a Japanese scientist in 1989, is that you see this pattern emerging on the other side if you send through single electrons one at a time. And if you see it recreated, it's one of the spookiest things that you've ever seen.
And it says that it basically passed through two at once. It's in two places at once.
With just a little bit of understanding of the concept, it's remarkably spooky.
Galileo was pretty good at this.
Well, one of the top experiments was the Leaning Tower experiment, which science historians have shown that it's not apocryphal. It probably really did happen.
And remind us of how that experiment went.
Well, he climbed to the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and he dropped two balls, one of which was much heavier than the other, and they arrived at the bottom at just about the same time.
And it dispelled the myth that actually a heavier object travels faster than a lighter object.
The Aristotelian notion that an object that's twice as heavy is going to travel twice as fast.
And, of course, that proved that the force of gravity is the same everywhere.
That gravity affects everything equally.
And that's what's your impression of the super collider as a beautiful experiment? It's kind of unwieldy, and you can't actually do it in your basement.
Well, that's an interesting question, because of the 10 experiments that I described in my list, they were all tabletop experiments done by two or three people. And the question is, can you still have beautiful science in the age of big science? Can you still have beauty in the age of big science? But something like the Higgs is sort of like what Eratosthenes did, in that it connects. It's something very tiny. It happens that
the Higgs boson, which is what they're detecting over there, is
something very tiny and small, and yet it has implications for cosmology. It connects very tiny, the very small scale with the very large scale.
And I guess, Robert Crease, we should be happy that you can't actually produce black holes on a tabletop. That could have disturbing implications for our universe, probably, wouldn't you say?
That would have big implications, yes.
Robert Crease is the author of The Prism and the Pendulum, the 10 Most Beautiful Experiments in Science. He's chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Stony Brook University. His next book is about beautiful equations. Lots of ways you can catch up with us at The Takeaway. You can go to Facebook, Friend Feed, Twitter, iTunes, thetakeaway.org. We're talking about music. What songs pick you up when you're down? Michael sent us an email. He says, "You, Me, Dancing by Los Campesinos." Sounds like 80s, but it was written last year by some Welsh kids. Irish Campesinos. God, you love our Welsh Campesinos. Here's your takeaway for today.
It's a bad feeling when people feel like it's over before it's even begun.
Yeah, and those are people in Chicago. That's Dave Zirin, sports writer and author of the book A People's History of Sports in the United States. The Chicago Cubs will not play this weekend because of Hurricane Ike. We're also covering Sarah Palin's recent television appearances. What did you take away from her interview? What questions haven't been asked? We've got a big debate going on our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji will be back next week. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.